Hi everyone, welcome to PA Talks, an interview series by Parametric Architecture, the world's most renowned avant-garde architecture platform about parametric and computational design. We meet the architecture and design pioneers on this podcast and talk about their careers, experiences, methodologies, and visions for the future. My name is Hamid Hasanzadeh, founder and editor-in-chief of Parametric Architecture Platform. Welcome to the show, and I hope you enjoy the conversation. To support this podcast, please check the links in the description. Make sure to follow our platform on Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, and support us on Patreon. You may listen to this conversation on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts. We have invited Portuguese architect Mariana Cabeguera to join us from London. Mariana is an urban designer and also a senior architectural designer at Zahid Architects. She graduated from AADRL Architectural Association Design Research Lab in 2017 and joined Zahid Architects. Since then, she has been a member of the competition cluster where she is in charge of offices' high-end design projects. She was a member of design team for award-winning projects such as Navi Mumbai Airport, Western Sydney Airport, Chongqing Terminal 3B, Beijing Exhibition Center, and most recently Shenzhen Tower C. Also, Mariana is going to lead a studio workshop at the Pacademy with the topic of Metafluid Studio starting in mid-May. You can check out the details for this studio from the link in description. Before starting this episode, I wanted to talk about Pacademy, which is an architectural educational platform powered by Parametric Architecture to spread the idea of using parametric design and computational tools in architecture. Pacademy has broadened its work experience and collaboration with pioneering architects and designers dealing with diverse and numerous topics of computational design and digital fabrication. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel and hit the bell notification so you don't miss any new uploads. Hi, Mariana. Thank you so much for joining and welcome to the show. I'm sure many people know you from social media and especially on Instagram. Can you talk a little bit about your background? Where did you study and how did you become an architect?
Okay, so I'll start from the beginning. So I am Mariana. I'm Portuguese. I'm an architect. Actually, I'm an architectural designer. So I did architecture in Portugal, my first master of architecture. I did a super long academic years, which I really don't recommend. And I think it really shows how it was not enough what I was learning and it was not exactly what I wanted from architecture. So that's why I studied for 8 years, unfortunately. So I did my first master in Lisbon in Portugal, and then I studied in Milan for a year. And then I had to move to London. And I say I had to because I felt like there was a lot more to architecture than what I was learning and what my graduation taught me in Portugal. So I moved to the UK.
Which year is this?
Which I was 24 when I finished, when I was in Portugal, I finished graduate my master. I think I was 24, 25. So, and now I'm 33.
2013, 14...
2013 or 2014, something there, yeah. And then, so, you know, more or less the kind of universities, I think they are still like that nowadays. It's very Le Corbusier, modernism, architecture stopped in the 60s or in the 70s, at least in my case, it kind of did. But then in reality, what happened to architecture, it was very interesting from the 80s onwards, right? All the CAD, computer aided design, and we don't learn this in our traditional universities, right? Any of these. So all the Greg Lins or the Peter Eisenmans or the Frank Gehrys or Zaha or all the revolution in technology that helped architecture. We stopped in Team 8 and Le Corbusier, and then we are using CAD on the side. So we kind of, we are missing this gap. So I moved from Portugal to, I was kind of a bit of a different student in architecture. I was more plastic. And I believe that the form had a responsibility in architecture and in culture. And it's very hard to explain this when you are 20-something. Actually, you come off as like a bit too different or kind of like an outsider when you believe in form so much. So I left and I looked for another school, like a post-graduation or a PhD. It was like whatever could help me to give me the skills to do design in architecture and to teach me what happened to the kind of architecture that we know these days, like Frank Gehry, Peter Eisenman, Libeskind and all that. So I looked for these schools and I looked for Columbia School, MIT, IAC as well. And then I landed in Architectural Association, so this mega school in London, where Zaha had been a student before, and Oma, Rem Koolhaas as well, Peter Cook. So all of these guys, they studied in the IA. So there was something there. I remember looking online and I was like, there's something here. And I decided to go, to travel on my own and to just go there and experience their open day. They were doing this open day where they show all of these courses they have, which is something I really kind of recommend to students to do. If you are interested in a school, just look for their open day and just go for a whole day and understand what's happening in there. So I went there and it was exactly on the same day as the design research laboratory, so DRL final presentations. And it was really funny because all of these people were walking around with these crazy models, super crazy. And I was really not used to that. I came from a very traditional school. So I was what is happening? So I followed the models, basically. Mega prototypes, super technological. And then I got in this huge auditorium, pitch black auditorium, and it was full of people. And then Patrick Schumacher walked in, and I will never forget that. Patrick Schumacher walked in, and I was like, whoa, where the hell am I? Where am I? And everyone like, Patrick, we are putting the panels on. And he's helping putting the panels on. And then they start talking, and it was Patrick Schumacher's studio presenting. And they started talking, and listen, my God, there was everything I was saying in Lisbon in DRL was 10 steps ahead. It was everything was correct, but there's another 10 steps that it has been done in architecture. So I felt at home. I felt this makes complete sense, especially that the city has a DNA, the city can evolve. And there is this combination between technology and architecture that we need to kind of take part of it. And we have the responsibility as architects to take a part of it. So that's kind of how I landed in the UK, and it's been 7 years. And from the DRL, I joined Zaha.
So you started studying your second master's degree at AADRL. What did you find differently at AADRL that there was not in any other school?
Well, DRL, the real name is Design Research, and it was exactly what it said. It's research of design and design in architecture, which is something that is very important. There is design in architecture that we try not to address when you are in a traditional school, but there is a lot of design in architecture. And when you start researching it, there's a lot of history on this design in architecture. So this research, DRL, it's about finding ways that bring the current technologies, whatever current technology that is happening, aiding design. So everything that is algorithm, in my case, it was a lot about algorithms and generative design as well. There are also other studies that are about technology in architecture in a way of fabrication way, robotic fabrication, preparing geometry for robotic fabrication. So it was everything that is about the current architecture and not the past one, which is something that other universities are so obsessed, to be honest. So that was something that the DRL was very different at.
Yeah, definitely. There are many great professors at AADRL that they are pushing the school forward. People like Peter Cook, like Patrick, Theodore, Shajai, and many other great people that I know most of them. Somehow they're in the front line of pushing the school forward and keeping it on top. This really makes sense, actually. How did you end up working at Zaha Architects, and what was the process of you getting into ZHA?
So when I joined the DRL, I had no idea that there was a connection to Zaha. Before DRL, I read some articles about parametricism, and that's where I learned about Patrick Schumacher. I didn't even connect Patrick Schumacher to Zaha Hadid. She was alive at that time. I came to DRL because of everything that I read on parametricism, basically. So there was no connection to Zaha. At some point when I joined, it was like the third day, I heard like a conversation between students saying, so you guys are applying to Zaha after. And I remember exactly who said, and this is a friend of mine these days. So like 6 years later, he's still my friend. And I looked at this guy, I was like, what? Like, people ask this question, like, are you applying to Zaha? You know, like, I came from Portugal. Portugal is really small. You really don't think about big firms, or like, you really think that you have to go to a small one and then a big one, which is a mistake. So when I heard, like, you guys are applying to Zaha after, I was like, whoa, like, there's a surreal chance for me here. So that's when I decided, okay, but I'm going to focus on the DRL, because DRL is a lot of work, like, a lot of work. DRL, like, you forget about Zaha, you forget that you need a job after, you're like, DRL. So when DRL finished, that was one thing that I knew, that I had to have a good knowledge on the software for Zaha, which is called Maya. And that was the only investment during the DRL that I was doing for Zaha, in that case. I knew I had to be good at the software. And that was like on the back of my mind. And then the rest, I was just like focused on the DRL. So when I finished, I spoke with Patrick Schumacher, and then I said that I was interested in joining. And then he recommended me to the head of the competition cluster, to Paulo Flores and to Melody. And I basically got an interview with them, and I was like nervous, and I was going online and on YouTube on like all of these military tricks to kind of control your breathing and control your nerves and like, you know, meditation 101 in 5 minutes. And
you were that excited.
Yeah, I was. And I was like reading all of their bios, and I knew all of their work. I knew everything that I had to know. And I was like outside of this building, like the old building of Zaha, like, I don't know what they thought about me, but I was like, you know, like breathing and like, and then I got in, I act super cool, super normal, super chill, you know. Like, you need me as much as I need you, so let's get on with this. And and then I got hired, and it's been 5 years, on this cluster, on Zaha cluster.
Congratulations, you've been there for 5 years. And what do you see is unique about Zaha Darktext that keeps it on top of the industry? And maybe you can discuss the methodologies, you can tell about the ideas, design process. What is something unique that makes ZHA on top of the industry? Even after Zaha, ZHA is really doing good in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I think it's very subjective. I'm going to say what I think is unique. I think other people have probably different opinions. I think there are probably two things in this office that are extremely unique. The first thing, and I think it's one of the most important ones, is Zaha Hadid architects can really afford to have the best designers and the best architects working in the same office, on the same floor, with the same softwares, on the same projects. And that's not very common. So they have the best of the best working together and learning together. And you understand that, how important that is. Years on, just very later on the game, you understand, okay, this office is what is running behind. I mean, what is running in front is important. All of these front people are important. What is running behind is a diamond. They are pearls. Like, I don't know if I will ever get the chance to have my own office with people as talented, as committed as the people who are designing at Zaha. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is the knowledge that is running there. Because they started building for so long ago, like say 40 years, 50 years, let's say, I'm not sure. There is this knowledge that keeps passing from like the most experienced people to the new people. And this is also like a diamond inside of that office, because we do complex geometries, or they do complex geometries, but there's always someone with a bit of experience on that complex geometry, and then someone else who can complement that, and that gets passed. So those two things, those two little things, are probably the more unique part of Zaha, is the experience that the office has and definitely the people behind the screens.
Right. I'm going to ask you about the working culture that you've mentioned earlier. How does the working culture at ZHA work? For example, you're from the competition team, and what happens when you win a competition? What's the process? Who takes care of the project after that? Maybe you can talk a little bit about this.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Let's take like one competition, for example, like as a demo. So you get a brief, they get their resources. So when they say resources, is how many designers we can have, how many senior designers we can have, how many leads, and there's one director. And they get like a small group of designers, let's say. And sometimes they get also people from planning, so other designers from a little bit more the 2D world. So we bring the 3D world and then the 2D world, and let's say we are a team of 10, 6, okay. And this all depends on the resources that the project has, that this competition has. If it's paid competition, if it's not paid, how much the office is like, how can I say, how much the office is interested in invest on this competition. And that also tells how many resources you can have. And resources is us, so people working behind the screens. Yeah, that's something that is very important. So let's say we are 6 designers. We get the brief. 3 of us or 4 of us start doing like 1,000 of different options on typologies, on topologies. Okay, they are not like this creative craziness. It's about the buildings that have been done in the past, the buildings that the office has been done in the past, and we brainstorm together, we bring the director, we all discuss what's the best way to go, we pick one of the options, all of the other options die. So all of us designers have like thousands of dead options. Some of them are really good actually, but you know, they didn't make the cut. And then the whole team decides, okay, let's work on this option. And then you basically increase the number, the size of the team, and you start like developing this option till you get like not construction drawings, of course, and this is competition, but let's say a rhino healthy stage with good 2D documentation. And let's say this is a competition on average 3 months, and then you submit and you start a new competition.
Right. I've been talking about this with some other people at ZHA as well. I was curious to understand if there are different clusters of specialities that they are working on old projects, or there are different teams that each one of them has its own computational designer, for example, its own BIM specialist, or that they are just taking care of certain projects. Maybe you can enlighten us a little bit about it.
Let's say it's a big office, so it has like small departments, we call them clusters. So you have like the code cluster, and they do all of this research, I bet you know this. And then you have the design cluster, which is more interior design. Then you have our cluster, which is more competitions and commissions with, I would say, high standard design. And then, not that the other clusters are not high standard, but there is like a... and then you have all of the other clusters. You have cluster 1, cluster 2, cluster 3, and like they all have their own projects. And then you have the BIM cluster. And when you're doing resources, so when you're like a director managing resources, you're getting one person from BIM, 3 people from the ZH cluster, so my cluster, 2 people from the code cluster, and then you go for a competition. So they're kind of shopping from cluster to cluster.
Have you ever wanted to connect with pioneering architects and designers to learn more about parametric design and computational tools? Then you may wish to join PyCademy, an educational platform powered by parametric architecture to spread the idea of using parametric design and computational tools in architecture. PyCademy has broadened its collaboration with pioneering architects and designers, dealing with diverse and numerous topics such as computational design, 3D printing, robotic fabrication, procedural methods, space architecture, metaverse design, design in VR, AR, and many more topics. You can register and join the live workshops or watch the previous studio workshops recordings. To learn more, you can visit parametric-architecture.com/PyCademy. So you always talk about fluidity in architecture. Can you tell us what exactly is fluidity and what are its principles?
So I would say that fluidity is probably an iteration of organic architecture, because organic architecture was coined by Frank Lloyd Wright, as we know. It was mostly based on nature. And then there is something about fluidity in architecture that is not just nature, but it's also about behavior. It's also about humans. So it's the way we dialogue, it's the way we talk, it's everything that is human related is actually fluid. There's nothing stiff about us. This architecture that we have been creating, we have been kind of enforcing these spaces on us, and these 90 degrees, it is as artificial as it could be. And the reality is, if you question yourself, like if you really question yourself, what would be the best type of architecture, of the best type of spaces that humans, that comfort would give to humans, would it be a stiff space? Would it be a stiff city? Most likely not. Most likely it'll be a fluid one. And I'm being biased, and I'm already giving you the answer, but if you really think about that, does your best comfort comes from your 90 degree corner of your bedroom? Probably not. We made that up a long time ago, and then we decided to stick to it. And then we decided, okay, we're going to stay here. since the Stone Age, right? Like, we have a rock, we have another rock, and there's a T, and this works really well with gravity. So let's go with it. And then we forgot everything else. We forgot that humans are fluid. The way we behave and the way we think about ourselves and the way we think about life is a fluid way. The way we travel in space is a fluid way as well. So it's not just organic, because it's not just nature, it's also us. And that's what I take as fluid architecture.
Right. I'm going to point out a question out of the script. What are your thoughts on parametricism and the style that Patrick Schumacher is mostly promoting it? Is fluidity inspired by parametricism?
It's a hard question, but I'm going to be very honest and transparent about this. I think that at some point, I said this in the other podcast, and I'm going to repeat, I think that 90% of the people who talk about parametricism don't know what parametricism is. And the other 10% who know also know that most of the things that we see are not parametric architecture. But in a way, we tied parametricism with an aesthetics, with an aesthetics that recalls Zaha and recalls fluid architecture. So we see fluid architecture, and you Google fluid architecture, and parametricism comes after. It's wrong. They are not even, they don't have to be connected or correlated. I think in a way, parametricism was a way to create a fashion and a trend that is tied to a specific aesthetics, sometimes wrong, sometimes correct. And that is almost superficial, but we always like to put things on in boxes, right? Even the way we study history, all of these isms, right? The modernism and the constructivism, all of these isms are basically just boxes where you put something aesthetic that you recognize visually, and then you say, oh, this is definitely modernism. And then Patrick is kind of trying to do the same with parametric architecture, parametricism. So he's trying to put everything that is contemporary in the parametricism box. And it's very useful for us to say, oh, this is definitely parametric architecture. But in reality, parametric architecture means that you use parameters, and sometimes I'm not using any parameters, I'm just doing free modeling, and it's fluid architecture, and it's definitely not parametric architecture. And people look at it and they say, this looks like fluid architecture, it looks like Zaha, this is definitely parametricism, and it's I know it's not. And we just let it pass because it's easier.
Right. I mean, there are many architects, at least the ones that I have interviewed, they totally disagree with the ideas of parametricism as a style and disagree with Patrick Schumacher. I mean, I really love Patrick, but
Patrick.
Right.
I'm sorry.
I mean, I really love Patrick, but there are many disagreements from other architects about his thoughts on parametricism. Basically, parametric design is a tool, and we've been doing it since the beginning of the time. parametric architecture, it's impossible not to do parametric architecture. Everything that we do, it has parameters, and we care about these parameters. After the emergence of computers and the rise of computers, we were able to define more parameters into the computer environment to analyze, to calculate, to optimize the form, the shape, the environment. But putting it into a box, it's something that is different.
Yeah, it helps them, but then it also creates a lot of confusion, especially on students. Like, I have students reaching out and asking me, can you teach me how to design parametric architecture? And I'm like, no, because I don't do parametric architecture. So I can't. Do you want me to show you how to do free modeling? I can do that. Is this what you're looking for? And then I send them the image, and then they're like, yes, exactly that. I'm like, but the parametric architecture, parametricism is wrong. It's like, it's semantics. It's not correct.
That's right.
It's a box. Probably in the future, it will be a very useful box.
And nowadays, there are many other softwares that are being emerged with design and architecture. For example, Houdini, Rhino, and Grasshopper were around for some time. Revit, Maya. What kind of digital software do you use in your daily practice, in your daily design life?
So right now, I think there's no secret that I'm focused in Maya. And I'm focused in Maya from all aspects, not just because of the outcome, but Maya has a lot of interest for students to learn, to be accepted in different offices, and for offices to get students with good skills on Maya. So it comes with a lot of little profit. So in a way, personally, I like the way Maya allows me to do the architecture that pleases me, in a very simple way to say it. And then on the other side, there is this interest that I think that the students will probably have to know it and to apply it and increase their skills and join offices that are like bigger firms, for example. So Maya and Rhino are like my best softwares right now.
Right. In about 2 weeks from now, you're going to lead a studio workshop in our academy, which is called Pacademy, with the title of MetaFluid Studio. Can you tell us what is this studio about and what will be the key takeaways of students from this studio workshop?
So basically, MetaStudio and MetaFluid Studio is exactly this opportunity that we have to do the fluid city and the fluid spaces with no, let's say, additional costs that the reality comes with. And that's exactly what the studio is going to explore, is a cyber urban environment, so a virtual city that is fluid. And that doesn't mean just curves. It means that the way you travel through the city is a fluid journey, and we will be exploring that in a virtual scenario, in a virtual incubator, basically, with no costs at this point. And it's also a studio because it's kind of researching how can we be part as architects on the Web3 or on Metaverse. We do have a responsibility, and it's also fun for architects to be part of what is coming, and not just for 3D artists and game designers, while a lot of architects are kind of questioning the Web3 and questioning the metaverse. We have a lot of game designers already taking place and already taking the advantage of this situation. And we are architects. We are one of the best creating spaces, to be honest. So we should be the first ones getting there. And I hope this studio kind of helps these students to have a step on it already.
Yeah, right. We're really looking forward for this studio workshop because it's almost 2 weeks left to start. We filled up all the seats, actually. We have opened extra 4 seats. They are full now as well. Generally, Pacademy tries to show the ways that pioneering are pushing forward. And with the emergence of new tools and technologies, there are different alternative paths that architects can take. For example, designing for virtual worlds. It was not common maybe 10 years ago. It was not common 4 or maybe even 2-3 years ago. But now, being a meta architect and designing metaverse environment is going to be common. And we try to show different paths that architects can take in their career. And for this specific one, combining fluidity with virtual worlds, it's going to be something really unique, I think. And I really can't wait for this studio workshop.
Yeah, me neither. I think we need to stop being this afraid of the new stuff that is coming, because it has so many opportunities. And to watch other people taking it when we could take it earlier. I think it's the best time for architects to engage on this. And that's why I'm also super excited on the studio myself to step on it and to also understand how does this work for architects and how can architects contribute on creating digital cities, right? We do the virtual cities and we do the real cities. Can we do the virtual ones as good as these ones or better even? So yeah, I'm super excited as well.
Exactly, right. Mariana, how do you use social media? This was a question that we received in our messages to specifically ask from you how you are managing your time. For example, you go to gym, you go to cafe, you go gathering with friends, you work hard, you're doing great at work and on everything, but you also have time to post, you also have time to take pictures, write captions, teach workshops. How you're doing this and how you are keeping this in balance?
It's a super hard question, and yeah, you're right. And I get that asked a lot. So it's hard because the obvious answer is the answer that no one wants to hear, but it's time management. It's awful, but it's a reality. Time management, it was something that I was the worst at when I was in university. I was wild. I was wild in the way I was organizing my time. It was completely chaotic. I was working till hours that I killed nights and nights and nights and nights. And then when I understood how bad I was at time management, then I actually got a comment from a teacher on my final master thesis on how bad I was on time management, I decided I'm going to put my head and I'm going to put all of my energy on time management. And then with time, I really understood that what I need to do are tasks. I do also procrastinate a little bit, but I also don't let that procrastination go very far. And I have my daily tasks, and from this hour to that hour, I'm doing this and then that and then that and then that and then that. And this sounds boring, but with time, it's very fluid. The way you control your time is really important. And I sleep 8 hours. I don't kill my sleeping hours. They are gold, diamonds for me. And about social media, I think at some point I understood that we are also connecting in this world through social media, like you know. So we do have our little metaverse for ages now, where we are communicating and we are kind of dialoguing on another dimension, which is, on my case, it was just Instagram. I never had Facebook. And when I understood that there was this world happening and these new trends happening on the side, I decided, okay, I'm going to invest on this as well. And I'm going to put my time on this social media in the same way that you put as well, for example.
Exactly. That's absolutely right. Today, we have reached to 1 million followers on Instagram. And
congratulations.
Thank you. We did start it from zero followers, actually, in 2016. And now it's 1 million after 6 years and 1 month. We are now 1 million.
Imagine opening when you open the Instagram account and you have one follower. 10 friends, your mom.
I see. I can imagine. Yeah, right.
And it is time management, right? You're not just organically feeding your Instagram. You're not organically just posting. You are tasking. It's tasking. It's management.
You need to put a lot of time. And it's not just Instagram. We have website, we have LinkedIn, we have Pinterest, Twitter, Facebook. These are all very complex stuff that you need time management to do all these things together. And without time management, you can't even post just daily on Instagram. I totally agree with you. And without time management, it's very hard to manage.
Yeah, I agree.
Which one of ZHA's projects are your most favorite ones?
So usually, actually, my favorites are from this book that I don't think it's published and I don't think it can be published, but it's called The Unbuilt. And I saw this going around the office. I saw it on a PDF. And the Unbuilt projects of Zaha are like the best projects the world will never see. And they have projects that are absolutely like heartwarming. It's the Unbuilt part of Zaha is really like...
But they were on press, right? We have seen them definitely. Which one of them you like the most?
The ones that you have seen that I think it's undoubtedly one of the best of Zaha is the Edavar Center, so the Baku project. So the one that has like the hair wave. I call it the hair wave. And then specifically, I think that project did like a favor to architecture, definitely. It really raised the bar to architects. Rather you like it or not, this project raised the bar.
Definitely, one of my favorite ones.
And then definitely the concert house inside. That's my favorite.
Exactly. Which project or competition that you have worked on represents the best of your architecture?
So probably...
Let me guess, Sea Tower?
Yeah.
Guys, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Please subscribe to PA Talks podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts in order not to miss a single episode. Also, you can find out more by going to parametric-architecture.com/PA Talks. Again, I want to mention PA Academy, or you can call it Pacademy, which is an educational platform powered by Parametric Architecture to spread the idea of using parametric design and computational tools in architecture. You can register and join the live workshops or watch the previous studio workshops recordings. Please share this podcast with a URL to inspire a friend. Also, you can use hashtag PA Talks on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook to give us a feedback about the podcast. Thank you.